Will AI ultimately make free market economics obsolete and destroy democracy in favor of digital dictatorships? We continue to talk about this today on Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. We've been talking with Dr. Jay Richards about a recent article by Yuval Noah Harari that posits that AI will ultimately destroy democracy and favor digital dictatorships. If you haven't listened to the first episode of this, I would advise you to do so. It'll give you more of a foundation for listening to this. And we're just going to jump in. Jay, I'm gonna skip the introduction because... Sure. You're a guy that needs no introduction, right? As they say.
And they should everybody should listen to the first episode.
Yeah, maybe. That's right. That's right. If they want to find out who you are, very, very, very impressive and credentialed gentleman. We were talking about this paper by Harari, and mm-hmm. we will include a link to it on the bottom of this podcast in case you want to read it and read it void of our comments, if you want to read it in its pure, unadulterated form. One of the things that that I've been doing with Dr. Richards is going through some of the quotes from the paper, and we're kind of commenting on them. One of them, which is near and dear to my heart, is the idea of creativity and the ability of computers and AI to actually create. Jay, let me read you a quote and get your reaction to this. The world of chess serves an example of where things might be heading. One of the ways to catch cheaters in a chess tournament today is to monitor the level of originality that player exhibits. What do you think?
Well, I guess he's treating originality as if that's a kind of unique property of creativity. But I mean, normally, I mean, I suppose that's one of them. But so once somebody creates something, it's not as if that is the sort of only way to do that. There's also expertise. There's also learning a skill. And so if somebody's really good at, you know, shooting a rim shot in basketball, what it is it's a skill. And we would say, look, there's human ingenuity in that. And I think that he's sort of imagining that chess players, for instance, are going to become obsolete. But I mean, I would say, let's ask somebody like Garry Kasparov what he says. Garry Kasparov tells us that it's exactly the opposite, that, yeah, chess software, it's not creative in this. I mean, it churns through lots of different games and, you know, you can load them up with millions of previous games. Nevertheless, there are these interesting hybrids, these centaurs between human beings using programs, and they're doing things that neither could do on their own. And so I just think, yeah, he's essentially confusing. In this case, I think he's confusing originality with expertise.
I actually agree. I think if a computer makes a really interesting new move, it is something which he is I'm referring to the computer as a male. The computer has actually learned that from a training process. And the idea that you catch chess cheaters by looking at the originality of their plays, and that in some way is creativity, is frankly kind of absurd. The other thing that I would argue with is the definition of creativity. Chess software is not creative. If a chess program learned to play Go or invented another board game, then I would say, yeah, boy, it's being creative if it did so without being programmed to do that. So that is creativity, and that would be creative. So
Right, this is the sort of difficulty, especially when you get into machine learning, and he gives some examples of this in which solutions are found that the programmer himself didn't put into it. Except that, of course, you know, look, these are statistical algorithms that are culling information, and they're designed to do that. But if you think of creativity as something that's a purposive activity of an intelligent agent that chooses from among a range of possibilities for something new, you have to sort of beg the question and assume that the machine is conscious in order to call that creative, which I actually do think, if you read his book, especially Sapiens, he very often speaks of inanimate objects as if they're conscious. For instance, he says, rather than us domesticating wheat, it's really better to think about what wheat wanted and the ways in which it domesticated us. And he's only half joking when he speaks that way.
Really?
Yes.
Half joking, not totally
only joking. Half joking when he speaks that way. And if you think about it, I mean, if you're a really hardcore materialist, then we ourselves are not agents. We are way stations. And this, there were moments in this impersonal process of cosmic evolution, which is actually, and turns out that's what he thinks in Homo Deus, that we're passing on to a sort of technological stage of evolution in which human beings will be obsolete. He thinks Homo sapiens will be gone in 200 years. And so this kind of thinking actually follows, I think, from his deeply committed materialism.
I actually read a quote of his on Wikipedia where he basically says that. I didn't follow up the source, but he said basically, I forget the time period, there will no longer be people in the universe. This is a hard AI sort of stance. And it seems that he's firmly entrenched in that idea.
Yeah, exactly. And what's funny is, I mean, his training is as an historian, but in some ways, I often argue that these debates, when it comes to AI, they might look like they're about technology, when in fact, very often they are debates about metaphysics and philosophy. You know, what's the nature of human beings? What's the nature of machines? And because he's already a thoroughgoing materialist, he doesn't have any kind of in principle reason not to say, well, if we're just machines determined by the laws of physics, surely machines we design can ultimately exceed and so replace us.
One of my favorite sayings by Niels Bohr, the pioneer in quantum mechanics, is the forecasting is very dangerous, especially if it's about the future.
And, that's right.
And we see in here so many places where maybe, could be, these hedge sort of terms in the forecasting, which really, I think, detract from any substantive scholarly presentation. Without some domain expertise behind it, forecasting in a silo isn't going to get you anywhere.
It's not. And I, you know, reading this piece and then reading Homo Deus and then recently reading George Gilder's new book, Life After Google. Well, Gilder has had an amazing track record of predicting technological innovations 10 and 20 years in the future. But he doesn't go in for these kind of fanciful materialist ideas. And he always talks about the nature of human creativity is it's about surprise. And so you might be able to talk about trends, but we don't actually know what people are going to invent and create tomorrow. We don't know all the kinds of jobs people are going to do because they don't exist yet. And so in some ways, it comes down to, well, do you have faith in the capacity of human beings to actually create value and to continue to create value? Or do you buy this kind of, frankly, very depressing materialistic story, in which case, you know, you're looking for disaster around every corner.
Exactly. Here's another quote, your reaction. Now, this is said in context in a very negative, sad way. He says, people will need to retrain and reinvent themselves, not just once, but many times.
This is a weird complaint because this, if you anyone that's read Aristotle knows that, that's the whole life of virtue. I mean, what we're supposed to do is read John Paul II. He has an encyclical from 1987 in which he says, through our work, we create things that were not there before as creatures made in the image of God. And we, in a sense, become even more human than we were in the beginning. Of course, you are human by your nature. But it's the nature of human beings to be able to, you can choose the good or you can choose the bad. And if you habitually choose the good over and over, you in a sense kind of rework what you are and who you are, and you become more than you were at the beginning. I think that's good news. It's we're not just a hamster running on a wheel and not getting anywhere. Now, he's exactly right that people that are, say, graduating from college today are going to have to pivot a lot more than people had to 50 years ago. The age of going to college for 4 years and then assuming that you'll have exactly the same job for the next 4 years or the next 40 years, I think that's unlikely just because of the pace of technological change. But whereas he sees this as a disaster, I see this as an opportunity for us to grow more in our capacity as humans.
I agree with you so much. Autobiographically, as a professor, I tell other professors, if you're a good professor in engineering, which is my area, you need to actually re-earn your PhD every 5 to 7 years. And doing that is such a invigorating process. It keeps you always on the treadmill and keeps your life very, very exciting.
So it does.
I don't see that this is a problem at all. I don't know how it translates to all other vocations, but certainly in mine, it's something that we want to do, continual reinvention.
Yeah, and you know, there's a funny little book by Scott Adams, the Dilbert cartoon guy, who's kind of, again, himself, he's reinvented himself as a social commentator, but he has a book on failure, and I can't remember the title, but it's essentially how to fail at almost everything and still win big. And he talks about something called talent stacks. And so talent stacks is where you develop, you become pretty good at several different, really different things that kind of overlap. And he used himself as an example. He's not by any means the best cartoonist in terms of his actual expertise. He's not a great business mind. Nevertheless, he figured out how to draw. He did get an MBA second at the bottom of his class at Berkeley. He spent years working in office situations. And then he combined those two things into a winning comic strip. And so that's how I think people ought to think. Think about developing several different kinds of skills. You don't have to be the very best at that thing, but you might be the unique person in the universe at stacking those different talents in some kind of creative and new way.
Yes, I actually think it's a very exciting thing to do. I think, though, coming from a blue-collar family, which I do, that's a little bit scary maybe for somebody that makes their work in a union and works for, yes, or works for an individual company. It's very scary to not work there anymore and to actually make a transition.
It is. And I think that's the real, the cost of the information economy that we need to spend a lot of time on, because it's one thing to say, well, you know, there are going to be amazing new jobs come online next year. But if you've lost your job today and need to pay the rent next week, that's sort of cold comfort. And so I do think that disruption itself is a cost. I just think that it's also an opportunity. And so what we want to do is figure out, how do we mitigate the downsides and maximize the upside?
Exactly. Roman numeral 3 of Harari's paper is titled The Rise of Digital Dictatorships. This, again, is forecasting, which if it's in the future is very dangerous. As many people lose their, this is the quote, as many people lose their economic value, they might also come to lose their political power. The same technologies that might make billions of people economically irrelevant might also make them easier to monitor and control.
Well, this is based on this assumption that everybody is going to become economically valueless. But, you know, Marx made the same argument in the Communist Manifesto in 1848. He said, as technology becomes more and more, makes people more and more productive, this is what he predicted, that workers in factories would get paid less and less because the machines would do more and more of the work. And so the workers the capitalists, people that own the factories, could pay the workers less and less. Well, what actually happened in 1848 is the wages of workers was going up rather than down. And every economist understands why. A person with a tractor has much more valuable labor than a person with a shovel. And if you're competing for labor and everybody has tractors, that means the people driving them, their labor is going to be more valuable. I just don't buy this idea that because high technology does some things that people are doing now, suddenly people are obsolete. They will simply do different things and interact and be augmented by technology in different ways. But unless you actually think that, first of all, we're machines, and so therefore everything we are can literally be replaced by machines, I don't think that we're in any different situation than human beings were in say 1776, when most people were literally using labor to do farming. And now less than 1.5% of the population in the country lives and works on farms. That rest of the 95% that used to farm is not all out of work. They're doing things that didn't exist in 1776.
Okay, here's another quote. We are unlikely to face a rebellion of sentient machines in the coming decades, but we might have to deal with hordes of bots that know how to press our emotional buttons better than our mother does.
Well, it's weird because at the beginning of the sentence, he said we don't need to worry about sentient machines. And then in the second part of the sentence, he speaks of them as if they're sentient, right? As that they know how to do things. They're manipulating our emotions. And this is a very sort of strange thing because, I mean, which is it? And the truth of the matter is he actually does think sentient beings, or beings at least as sentient as we are in his view, are sort of around the corner. But what he's essentially talking about is algorithms that are very good at anticipating the kinds of things that we want. I'm fine with that, honestly. I like the fact that Amazon can anticipate the books that I like based upon my previous purchases, because the alternative is that it's just a sea of millions of books and I don't sort of know anything. And so I think that's what he's talking about. Insofar as he's worried about people manipulating us through highly sophisticated advertising and marketing, great, let's talk about that. But that's ultimately what we're talking about. We're talking about more sophisticated ways of doing marketing.
And I thought, heck, that's what psychologists have been doing for years with advertising. They Absolutely. Want to, they want to sell us something. And as far as the Amazon targeting the sort of things that you want, that only works if you don't share your Amazon Prime with your daughter. And so I get all of these advertisements of how I should buy new baby bottles and
teenage daughters. And so for me, it's leather boots. For some reason, those are the biggies.
Oh gosh! Hey, I tell you what, I have a challenge. I think we could either go on with a longer podcast, or we could continue this in a third episode. We're up against 15 minutes, and I'd prefer to do the latter, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay, no problem.
Okay, so we'll end this podcast with Dr. Richards, and we'll continue it in a third installment the next time on Mind Matters. Until then, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.today. That's mindmatters.today. Mind Matters is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.